Today is Tuesday. It's April 1st, 2025. Be careful, Barb. Don't hurt me. Today, this is a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Barbara Phillips. Barbara spells her last name P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S and goes by Barb, and I'll be calling her that during this interview. Again, this is part 12 of our oral history series, and this interview is being conducted at our kitchen table here in Flagstaff, Arizona. Good afternoon, Barb. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Great. We left off in 1978, 1979.
Ooh.
You're living in Flagstaff. You and Art Phillips have a house in Flagstaff. Art is working for both of you are working for the Museum of Northern Arizona. I had asked you last time about an archaeologist named Robert Euler, E-U-L-E-R, and he went by Bob. And I wondered if you knew Bob and had any recollections of him, and when did you maybe first meet him, and do you have any stories about him at all? Barb's shaking her head. Going,
Well, I do have a couple, not relevant to his work, but I did know him. And I found him a very pleasant man, and he was really enthusiastic about his archaeology and that sort of thing.
Okay.
The main connection that I remember is that he had a house on Roundtree Road.
Okay.
In Fort Valley.
Okay.
And the access to that house was through the land of Dr. Charles Avery. So way late after Dr. Euler had died, a son, or I believe, had inherited the land and wanted to make sure that the access that they had been using was recorded, that sort of thing, that it became, you know, known that that was the way to get into the land. And so Chuck worked with that person on that aspect of it. The other thing that I remember was Jim Babbitt wanted to put some plaques in Heritage Square in downtown Flagstaff, that was adjacent to the Babbitt buildings down there.
Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so he asked people that he knew that had information, like, so he asked Bob Euler to write something on archaeology.
Okay.
He asked Bill Breed to write something on the geology.
Uh-huh.
He wrote, Jim Babbitt wrote history, and I wrote on the biology of the Flagstaff area, which was based mainly on C. Hart Merriam and the articles that we had written on the life zone concept and that sort of thing. So it was a little more biology and a little less botany for me, which, you know, but so I did that. I assume there's some more plaques down there, but I don't know who were involved with the other ones. But that was sort of interesting that the four of us all knew each other well, and Jim just said, okay, Bill, you there, you know, how about Barb here and Bob here? And so it tied together in that respect.
Did you see those plaques? Are they still
there? Oh, they're
there?
Still there. Oh, yeah, so yeah. People walk on them.
Well, so there's the bricks, with people's names in the bricks. So these are amongst the bricks?
They're not amongst the bricks. They're actually closer to, they sort of curve around the amphitheater there. So if you start over in Aspen Street and...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Aspen there.
And then walk around the curve type of thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
you'll go and see these plaques.
Well, I'll go look for them.
Yeah, yeah, they're metal.
Okay, so so you would have met Bob when he was coming to the museum for functions?
I suppose,
so?
Yeah.
Okay.
Things like that,
and I didn't realize that he lived out on that part of town.
Yeah, he did.
Okay.
And so he was a friend of Chuck's, and who enters into my picture later. Chuck Avery.
Chuck Avery. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So this is Dr. Chuck Avery.
Right.
Have I asked you about Dr. Avery?
Uh-uh.
Oh, well, should we? Was this about this time that you first met him?
No, I met him in 1977.
Okay.
When I took over being the editor of the Arizona, I think at that time it was just Arizona Academy of Science Journal.
You mentioned that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And did I mention about, you know, we met in the forestry building at the time for a board meeting of the Arizona thing. And he was the president-elect, president-elect, president, and past president 3 of the 4 years that I edited the journal.
Okay.
And so we would go on trips to board meetings to Tucson or Phoenix or
right. You
and Flagstaff.
Him, and
yeah.
You mentioned that his second son was Nate Avery.
Yeah, he had a daughter in there too.
Right. And you mentioned that he was very pleasant, easygoing. Right. Okay, so we've covered him
a little bit.
Got any more recollections of him since we're here?
Well, he was also involved with the. I need to get at my notes.
Okay.
And my memory is a little bit strange right now. I'm concerned about other things going on in the world. Sorry about that. Professional societies. There we go. He was a member of Sigma Xi, as was I. And I had gotten in there as a student involved with that.
Okay.
And he was also a past president of that. I was a president-elect in 84, 85, and then president in 85, 86, and the past president in 86 and 87. But I got started in it somewhat later, but Chuck was also involved in that.
Okay.
But the time that I met Chuck, I just remember that his two young boys came to tell him that, you know, he was to be picked up. So I remember those children as 9 and 11 year olds or something like that, and not knowing they would become a big part of my life later on. So that was sort of interesting. I have a somewhat of a memory of that incident of meeting him and his two sons.
And he was
there.
A physician in town?
No, he is a professor at the university.
What was he teaching?
He taught. He was a forestry. School. He taught forestry, taught hydrology. He taught conservation classes. He became very active in the climate change issues. He was very active at the university too, in different roles.
Yeah, I'm asking you. I already asked you about that. You noticed the last time that he was in forestry and hydrology, conservation, right, studied forest canopy weather.
Mm-hmm. That's what he did for his research.
Right.
Top of a ladder way up above the trees.
Yeah.
But he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis before he went to Washington to work on his PhD. And so he was climbing these ladders already having a diagnosis of being unsteady on his feet and everything like that. So, and the doctor said, they did a puncture
spinal cord thing.
Mm. And said, well, there's the bad news. You have MS, but here's some Valium. Go ahead and live your life. Huh. And Chuck went, and threw that away and went ahead and lived his life.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So he didn't take drugs for many years for it.
Oh,
he just kept going.
Okay.
Going. And at that time, he had 4 little children and a wife, and they all moved to Washington, and he didn't have insurance.
Okay.
You know, I mean, medical, but not long-term or anything like that.
Okay.
Just... hard worker and
all right. What else was happening then in those years? This is the late 1970s, 78.
Yeah, this was 77 when I met him.
Yeah. You mentioned last time that you started picking up some work with the United States Fish and Wildlife Service.
Right, yeah.
What was that about?
Well, we sort of recognized that work in the Grand Canyon was just one aspect of what we could do at the Museum of Northern Arizona. And the BLM had contacted us, because we were plant people, to go look for some rare plants on the BLM lands on the Arizona Strip.
Right.
So we got in with Lee Hughes, which I mentioned before, I think.
Mm-hmm. This last interview,
yeah.
You mentioned him.
Yeah, uh-huh. And so we had at least a couple of years' worth of grants with them. And then the Fish and Wildlife Service was based out of Albuquerque for us. They didn't have a state office. They were just out of Albuquerque.
Okay.
But there was one person there that started working with us on some of the rarest plants. And then...
Do you remember?
There was an agave in Table Mountain area, just north of Phoenix.
Okay.
And I remember that one. And then cacti. They were interested in the cactus species. And it was just the small cactus plants, not saguaros and things like that.
Pediocactus,
some mammillaria, some plants that, you know, we didn't know much about at all,
okay.
Because they were sort of ignored. They were little,
mm-hmm.
You know, but they got trampled on by cattle and they,
sure.
You know, had a hard life and all
uh-huh,
that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And we just didn't know where they were and how big the populations were and what substrates they lived on, or if it was just because they weren't often collected that they were considered rare, or if they really were rare.
Okay.
So we started looking for some of them in the late 70s.
Okay.
77, 78, around in that time. And I remember we wrote up with what we found, and they Fish and Wildlife went ahead and listed them as endangered or threatened.
Okay.
Plants.
How would it work? They would get in touch with you and say, we think there's a plant in north of Phoenix. We're not sure what its range is or what kind of substrate it's in. Can you figure that out? And so you would drive out there and start walking around in an ever bigger circle?
Not exactly that way. Okay. So there were some people that were looking at herbarium specimens.
Okay.
And information in books.
This is USFWS people were doing that.
No. They, Nature Conservancy, actually.
Okay.
People, that kind of people did.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they were separate from us. They just
mm-hmm.
were looking up the information.
Okay.
And so that's what started it. And then we would use some of the information that they got and tried to go further and check it out in herbaria and stuff like that ourselves, too.
Mm-hmm.
If we've got a list of species, which we did, of, say, 7 or 8 species, let's see. The first ones we had were, I don't have how many on the BLM strip we did, just when they did it,
mm-hmm.
but then we started to get a few lumped together that they wanted us to look at. And we did those. And most of these, there are several of them on the Arizona Strip. 7, 8, it looks like 77, 78, 79, we did Arizona Strip.
With the BLM?
With the BLM, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But we
okay.
had started working on ones with Fish and Wildlife, too, because the cactus were actually listed, some of them in the late 70s.
Okay.
And it says here, 79 and 80, we did status report and final listing packages for 19 threatened and endangered plants submitted to the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Okay.
So they were sort of, and I, going out in the field to find them, it was so funny because some of them would only be collected one or two places, and then you would look up, go there, try to find them.
Right.
And I remember one of the one that we've worked the most on was really hard to find. I went out with another lady that worked with us, and the description was vague. That, you know, on the plant specimens that were in the herbarium, description of the location was like behind the plant inspection station in Holbrook, Arizona.
Okay, so at least you'd know Holbrook, all right?
So we went to Holbrook.
And look for the inspection station.
Well, we did. Yeah, the inspection station was. The roads had changed too in that period. Now we have an interstate. You know, all this kind of thing. So where exactly was it? Well, it was sort of over here.
Okay.
You know, so we started looking, and based on what they described as the habitat a little bit,
mm-hmm.
we started a ways away. You know, in the hills in the background.
Kind of walking towards it.
Were actually driving and walking, you know, getting out and looking and, mm-hmm, you know, right, drive some mm-hmm, more and look mm-hmm, and some
right,
more.
Right.
And finally, we went to this one, which would have been behind the station, and climbed up on the top and were walking around, and the soil was different and everything, and it fit the description of being different, you know, right, that we had.
Okay.
And so we were just walking around, and this other lady and I, and we went over around a curve, and there was a pile of petrified wood. And I said, well, this is interesting. Let's look at the petrified wood. And lo and behold, there was our plant right in the middle of the petrified wood.
Oh,
you know,
gosh.
And we got this cactus, and we said, oh, so then we thought it was associated with petrified wood.
Oh.
So then we started looking a little bit more, and we could pick up areas where there was petrified wood on the top of this mesa.
Huh.
And so that was where we first found it, you know.
Did you indeed,
but that was
find
after
it?
2 or 3 days
did you
of looking.
Did you find it with clumps of the petrified
wood? Well, that didn't turn out to be
type?
Its it didn't
no.
turn out to be its main habitat.
Okay.
But I mean the area was, but it doesn't have to be associated with petrified wood. But it was just we happened to
you
go over to look
there,
at the whole petrified wood and went, oh, this is going to be simple, which it wasn't that simple.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're never that simple.
Okay.
So that was one, for example. There's another one up again, along the Grand Canyon, the rims of the Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And that was known also from Lake Mead National Recreation Area, too.
Okay.
So there, and turns out also on the Navajo Res. So that one has a little wider distribution.
So the Fish and Wildlife Service would get a report of the plant, or would they go to the herbarium? Were they looking around for stuff?
The Fish and Wildlife people weren't doing the work.
Okay.
They were contacting people in the field who could do the work.
Okay.
The Fish and Wildlife people sat in the office and said, you know, what Washington was wanting them to do, and then they... and.
Well, let me back up a little bit, because I can well understand that if I'm driving along on the road and there's a plant check station, fruits and vegetable station at Holbrook,
right,
I'm going to stop. I might even get out. I stretch my legs. I'm a botanist. So I'm going to head out into the, I'm going to walk out and walk an acre or so, and I'm going to find something that looks unusual. It's a little pediococcus or something. And then I'm going to collect that, and I'm going to maybe put it in my plant press. How did that knowledge of that first collector work its way to Albuquerque, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and then back to you to go check it?
Okay. So the person that collected it, I believe, was Benson. And he was a botanist.
Benson who?
Benson's the last name.
Okay.
I have to look that up.
Mr. Benson.
Dr. Benson.
Okay,
Benson.
Dr. Benson. This would have been in... 1920,
1930?
50s. Okay.
He got interested in these small plants, cacti and stuff.
Okay.
I'm not sure. You're asking me questions where I haven't looked at the information
in
a long time.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. But but in any case, he got interested in the different species of this plant group.
Okay.
So he would go to wherever somebody had collected them. Now, whether he was the first collector, I don't know.
Right.
But he would go, and then he'd write up a description of the species and the location and the type of habitat.
Yep.
And then he would distinguish whether that species was like this plant over here in this other habitat, and he came up with several different species in this group.
But it's interesting because I didn't realize that, you know, Dr. Benson in the 1950s is looking at these plants and collecting them. Where was he, what herbarium was he putting them in? Don't know.
I can't remember.
Okay, would it be like Phoenix or?
California or someplace, okay. I don't know.
Okay.
There's a whole book he did on cacti, so I could look him up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And see what he did. Yeah.
Okay.
And he was a cactus expert.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Gosh, so, I wonder if he would have known Lois Jodder and Alzada Clover.
He might have.
Yeah.
They sort of came into the area and left.
Okay.
They were what they did in the Grand Canyon and everything.
Right.
But they came and left. They would have used. They were in the 30s. He was a bit later. He was in the 50s or so.
Right. His sort of Southwest desert geographical area sounds like it was bigger than theirs.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. He did all the cactus.
So his collection would have been somewhere.
Right.
And then someone, maybe from the Fish and Wildlife Service, would have gone to that herbarium and just took notes saying, wow, this is a rare plant. It'd be nice to know what its range is, and let's find somebody to go figure that out.
Yeah, I don't know how all that started. I mean, I think it was in '73 or something that the Endangered Species Act was signed.
Yeah, something
and
like
so
that.
Then they so it was real recent far as this stuff is going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they began wondering, you know, what plants merit protection because we hadn't studied it before.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And so we got in on the ground level, so to speak, and that we got a list of these species. Fish and Wildlife would send them out.
Okay.
After talking with botanists in the herbaria and the people that, like I said, were sort of checking any extra information that could be found on them. And so we would get a list and some information. And then we would try to track down more information and go to other herbaria, maybe that you know, like at the museum, nobody had really looked there for things. And Grand Canyon, even the Park Service Museum and places like that, whatever.
Sure.
And so we'd go out and have a general idea of the place and the habitat, and depending on how many specimens have been collected or whatever. And what we would look for too is where else did that habitat occur?
Okay.
Where it might be, you know, if it's on this mesa top, is it on this mesa top over here? If it's in this valley, is it over in this next valley? Is it, you know, 100 miles away somewhere? You know, is it in the other state and nobody's, you know.
Look there because the elevation's the same, the soil type's the same.
Yeah,
let's go look over there.
Yeah.
Makes
so,
sense.
So when we were starting out, you had vague information and you had to learn how to tell the plant from every other plant that looked similar and get it accurately identified. And some of them were still undergoing work by the botanists that specialized in those areas. So they changed knowledge and names and everything while we were even working on them.
Okay.
A lot of the different species were like that. Because once they got more collections, they could see, really this thing over here is that too, or there's this gradation between here and there.
Or these are different
here and there when they were thought to be the same. You know, I mean, all that kind of thing kept going on at the same time.
All right.
So when we did our status reports, we would report, you know, what's the known thing to begin with and then what we found. Then we had certain categories that they would ask us to fill out and find, and they didn't pay us too much. So we couldn't be as thorough as we would like in the long run, but we were starting, and they were giving them more information. And if we found it was all over the place, then they sort of got dropped out of the picture, and then they'd say, well, these out of this, you know, 50 species, maybe these 20 deserve to go moving forward right now.
Okay.
And so that's how it worked. And then they we weren't the only people that were working on it. Maybe some people in southern Arizona were doing it, and then we were doing it up here. Okay. But we did do, and by we, I mean my husband and I and Art, we did do all over the state of Arizona. But,
oh, okay.
But we didn't necessarily go out of state if it was on the border of the state. We didn't. Somebody in New Mexico might do theirs, you know, and somebody okay. in California would if it went over there.
Hmm.
But a lot of them were really restricted, and
huh.
so it was.
Interesting.
And then we had people that, once we got grants, we could pay other people to help us out. And, of course, we were still working on the Grand Canyon studies, so we hired people that were specifically working on the rare plant part
okay.
of it, too. And they would go out and scout it out and try to find these locations and everything, and then they'd come back with filling out the forms and all of this. And then before we could write our status reports, one of us would go out with them again to where they had found it, make sure that, you know, we're getting the right idea about the habitat
and, okay.
and the impacts. We also had to assess the impacts that we saw going, and they had different categories for those.
Okay.
And I will have to look them up, too. But they were just, you know, were they rare?
Okay.
Were they impacted by natural causes? You know, did they have disease? Were they eaten by, you know,
creatures?
Or did they have what we could assess about them? Yeah. You know, we couldn't answer every question, but sort of like was it just they were normally rare and they had impacts because they were normally rare?
Yeah.
The habitat was rare, or the pollinators were rare, or the whatever.
Right. Right.
Or were, like, humans causing some of the rarity? Were cattle impacting the area? Were they mining an area, digging up the soils?
Right.
You know, all these different aspects we had to look at.
Okay.
We also checked on what kind of climate situation they were in. And as best we could, like roads and things like that, like, was it becoming a development? Was the town expanding? Were the roads, like the interstate came through this one area, they just before it was listed, and so a lot of habitat was lost.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of assessment that we had to do on each species, but we just did a preliminary kind of thing
okay.
and wrote it up, and it has the dates on it, has who did it, where we went, what we covered, and everything like that. And some of them, if they were not looking like there was any real threats or pretty common or this or that, then they got put down lower in the whole thing or dropped off completely. So we had
okay.
we had different levels of status
hmm.
that they had. They had like candidate species, and then they had, you know, different levels as you went up, and the last two are threatened or endangered. Were they coming to that level of concern?
Okay,
and
so I'm still kind of puzzled. I'm thinking, okay, there's a plant I want to go look for. I guess the key here is I know it was collected, roughly.
Roughly, yeah.
So I'm going to go to that area and roughly right. start walking around.
Right. Yeah.
But I could also drive around. Mm-hmm. I could do a driving survey, and I could say, well, this is supposed to be in Blackbrush, and now I see sagebrush. I don't see blackbrush anymore. I better get out and walk around, and maybe because maybe they got it wrong, and maybe it is growing amongst sagebrush.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to
yeah.
see how.
Well, we
you
did
might...
that a lot in the BLM because that was a fairly unknown area. You know, it was a lot of ranches and
okay.
just open country. No,
mm-hmm.
nobody lives out there per very much.
Right.
And
would you meet the ranchers? Would you say, hey, we're
Well, Lee Hughes was the BLM person, so he was the contact out there. So it was, I'm sure he told the ranchers that people were going to be out there looking
right.
for the things, but we worked through him.
And there were hikers and backpackers out there, and
yeah,
people just
whatever.
Wandering around,
right.
so a rancher
yeah.
wouldn't you
yeah,
know,
they
go out there
really,
when he
yeah.
was out there. They'd be managing
yeah.
their cows.
Yeah. yeah. Well, one interesting study I remember was we were looking for a very tiny, fairly tiny plant, and it was like on ice cream clay hills,
oh.
like of multicolored clay hills.
Oh.
There's some over
okay.
North of Fredonia in that area.
Okay.
And
oh, and all
east
those,
of
sediments, those kind of
Well, and also on the Buffalo Ranch Road goes south from the down in the
House
lower
Rock, House Rock
area,
Valley,
and then
that's
there's a
right.
road that goes up to
The Wire Pass Road that goes
yeah,
up.
that one. There's a bunch of that ice cream kind of hills there on the right. So
Interesting.
we went there
Right.
and we did find the
They're
plant.
below the sandstone caps.
Right, yeah.
Okay. Huh.
Below the Vermilion Cliffs and
Yeah,
stuff like that. But
yeah.
anyway, so we did find the plants there.
Okay.
And so then we were looking for some other plants which happened to be along the highways.
Okay.
Those were phacelias, which I'm allergic to.
As
So
are
I
a lot
can't
of
touch them, but they're
people.
very pretty.
Yeah.
But they're very pretty. So and you know, in a wet year, you'd see them, you'd find them. And this was a different species than the most common one. It was a rarer one, and so that was fun to look for. And so we were driving through the strip looking for several species, maybe say 4 or 5 different species. And we went and we looked at the maps, and it looked like there was a record from way in the western part of the Arizona Strip. So we headed over there. And we went to some hills that looked like they had some clay things to it, and they were more barren and everything
Okay.
like that. They
So
weren't the
this would be over
standard.
by Hurricane. Now you've gone all the way
Yeah, we've
across
gone even
further than that.
further than
Somewhere
that.
St. George or even further west than that.
Well, we're south.
South
South.
of there, but
Yeah,
still
yeah,
that
yeah.
not Trumbull that side, but going ever
Right,
west.
going over there.
Okay.
And we so we stopped and walked over the hills. And it was late afternoon. We were walking around. We couldn't find the plants or whatever. And it wasn't too bad. It looked, you know, like I said, we didn't know exactly what we should be looking for. Was it just the soils, or was it, you know, just, you know, it happened to be here and it happened to be
Was it
there, maybe?
slope, an
Whatever.
aspect of the sun? I mean.
So anyway, then these gnats came out, and we were just getting bitten up like crazy and everything. And we were going to have to camp for the night. And we went, oh, this is a bad place to camp, and what do we want to do? So we piled in the car, and there were 4 of us. There were 2 of our assistants, women assistants that were with us. We piled in the car, and we said, well, you know, this doesn't look quite right. I think we're something off. Let's look through the literature some more. And so we looked through what we had on the species, and I found the original description of the location. And people hadn't put moved forward as they published later. They just cite the original place, but they didn't go into as much detail because you could go back to the original and look at. Well, we looked back at the original and went, there's no creosote bush here. You
Oh.
know, something that we knew, you know, hey, we must have the wrong location.
Too high.
So we looked and said, well, we want to get out of here anyway. We don't like these gnats, and we're
Right.
certainly not going to sleep well here. So we got back in our car and we drove until we got down into where there was some creosote. And we got out of the
Okay.
cars there and looked in. We went, well, the soil type looks really good here too. So let's camp here for the night, you know, because it was just too late
Yeah.
to do anything.
Yeah.
And got up the next morning. Sure enough, there it was.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Huh.
So
Okay.
you know, it's like sleuthing. You know,
Yeah.
you're a,
Yeah.
you know, you have to look at everything and go back to the original documents too, and hope that the original ones describe it enough that you can follow it.
Wait.
But after that, we started, like you said, ask the rancher, ask this, whatever. So I remember going into town and saying, yeah, this one says it's behind the cemetery. Where's your cemetery? You know, and so we've been, and it's in Fredonia. So we,
Huh.
you know, we got guided over there. When we were down in southern Arizona, we went to the man who, at the plant inspection station at the border, Nogales, had been really interested in plants.
Oh,
And
wow.
so he had been going around in the field and finding all of these
Oh, my
different
gosh.
species. So we went to him and we said, could you please tell us how to get to some of these locations? And he would tell us down to the hill, you
Wow.
know,
Cool.
out this road and turn here and go there and da 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 da. And so it became easier and easier as we worked more on them because we got the idea of who to ask, what to ask, you know, and things like that. And
The resident experts were.
Yeah. And some of the sometimes I remember one time we went out on the Arizona Strip, we'll stick with the Arizona Strip, and we went out and the roads weren't named or numbered or whatever, they're just sort of a mileage and then approximately, and we look at our map and whatever. And so we turned where we thought we should turn, and we drove out there, and there was a Conestoga kind of wagon, you know, that sheep herders have?
Mm-hmm.
Wagon there, and there was a tank. And so we went down the road, and we turned around, and we drove, and we drove, and we drove. And we're writing down our little mileages, you know, oh, there's a road off to the right, we didn't take that. Then go here, oh, we didn't take that road, and we came, uh-oh, we're back at the wagon. So then we turned around, we went again around, and we said, well, we took this road that time, so we're going to take this road this time. We went this road, and then we're all, oh, we're back to the wagon again.
Wow.
So we decided maybe it was we made the wrong turn way back here.
Yeah.
So then we went back to the main road, went down the road like half a mile, turned on another road, and that got us where we wanted to go.
Was that wagon being used, or was it abandoned?
No, I'm sure it was being used. I mean,
there's an abandoned wagon out on the Arizona Strip.
Oh.
And as the years went by, it was in ever greater stage of decay. And then somebody took the whole thing away. Lock, Stock, and Barrel just took it away.
Well, maybe we were at the beginning because it looked like it was being used then.
I wonder.
Yeah.
Huh.
Another
in the 70s, it would look better than it did when we saw it in the 90s. So.
Right. So did I tell you about the one that was up on top of the Vermilion Cliffs? I don't think I mentioned that story either. That was a really interesting one.
What was that?
Okay. So we had some locations up on the Paria Plateau above, you know, the Vermilion Cliffs. And so we drove up there with our truck, and we found the first plants. And we were driving like a circle around the top of the rim. And okay, it's a story like that. Okay.
We'll keep going.
Okay, so we found the first plants, you know, maybe on the top, and then we kept going around.
Yep.
And we had a location on the northeast side of the top of the rim.
Oh, did you?
And so we looked at the map, and there was a road there.
Yeah.
And we turned onto it, and we went down, and there was a little cabin. Mm-hmm. And so we stopped, and it had a little windmill, and so there was water. There was a tank there with water, you know. And we looked in the cabin and through the windows and stuff, and it looked like it was used.
Okay.
And we thought, oh, look, there's looks like food's in there, and you know, it's used.
It was using
whatever.
It as a line check.
Yeah, line check and stuff
and
like that.
Did it have like an active cattle trough with cattle?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I meant it had.
Whatnot.
Well, I don't know. The cows weren't around, but so we started down this track toward the location where our plant was supposed to be. And as we started going down this hill, we realized we were never going to make it back up the hill.
Because?
It was sand. Sand over bedrock, but the bedrock was too far below the sand.
Yeah.
So we went down until we hit, you know, a place where we could sort of turn off, and it was getting dark, and it was getting to be night and everything, and so we said, well, we'll have to camp here.
This is a two-wheel drive truck.
Yeah, but that wouldn't have made much difference.
Right,
anyway,
right.
And we drove it on the Gabes of Prieta and stuff like that. We drove it a lot on sand and everything. So, you know, we knew how to drive it. It was just too steep.
Mm.
So the two girls got out and same two and hiked up to the line shack and wrote a note and said, if you come back, it was like Saturday or Sunday, something like that. You know, they'd gone into town.
Okay.
But he wrote this note, if you come back, please check down in your back 40 that, you know, we'll probably be still down there and we could use some help. So Anyway, so then they came back. Art had his ham radio up with him. Okay. So it requires energy, but he knew he couldn't get out with it down there in the lower land. Yeah. Right. But there's the road across in Utah that goes parallel to that. You know, it's a ways away from the edge, but by going up the slope to the higher thing, he was pretty sure he would be able to reach somebody over there on that road.
So it's a handheld ham radio with batteries?
No, it's a box and stuff like that.
Was it in the car, wired to the car?
Oh, he didn't have it out yet because we hadn't been overnight yet, but he would have.
Okay.
Yeah.
But does it...
He has wires and stuff.
Does it run on the battery of the truck?
Yeah. So not only did he have to carry the radio, he had to carry the battery up the hill. But anyway, he did that. And I did it, or we both did. The girls were off going to the line check.
Okay.
And he was able to contact somebody on that road.
Okay.
A ham radio operator. I mean, you know, what's the chances? But he did. And so he said to them, well, this is where we are. And we knew exactly where we were. So he told them the coordinates and all of that kind of stuff. He says, go to the Museum of Northern Arizona on Monday, of course, because it was Sunday. And tell them to get a tow truck with a very long chain to pull us out.
Okay.
That was the idea he had for that. Okay. So, good idea. So we camped overnight, you know. I mean, we were just toward the beginning of our trip. We had plenty of food. Okay. You know, we knew water. We had water in the line shack. Right. We were, his other idea was, We should climb over to the edge of the Perea and hike down and go down over to
the Lee's Ferry.
I dissuaded him from that idea. I said, we don't know what kind of cliffs we'd run into or whatever, you know, whether it's possible or not. Let's just try this out first. So we tried those two techniques. So actually, I'll go with the people. We're able to contact the museum, and they got Don Keller.
Okay.
To look at the maps, and he's the archaeologist there and had been all over country around. And so he knew where we were, and he actually knew, you know, the road probably and where we'd made the turn and all this kind of thing. And so they ordered a tow truck, and the tow truck took off, you know, of course, like 9 a.m. or something like that.
Right.
The tow truck took off from Flagstaff. Okay, so much for the tow truck for now. We were out there early in the morning, and these cowboy came riding up with his nephew. So it was on horses.
Okay.
Two people on horses, a cowboy and his nephew, rode up and said, we knew right where you were.
Did they get the note?
They got the note. They got the note. They had come back. And so he said, well, you know, we can get you out of here. You just have to drive up you have to go up this not even a wash,
little valley kind of
thing? Yeah, little tiny valley. Mm-hmm. Go up, it isn't a valley, it's just the edge of the thing going up. And I said, I've been up that. You'll run into things like this. This truck will not, get over that.
Yeah.
He says, oh, well, at that point, take a hard left and then you go over the slope. And I said, but it looks just like this. He says, no, but it's got bedrock under it. This has happened before and stuff. And so Art says, well, I'm not going to try it. You do it. You drive the truck. And so he got out of the truck and the horseback rider, the cowboy, got in the truck to drive it. Art was holding the horse's reins, decides to get on the horse.
Okay.
He has ridden a horse before.
Right.
Anyway, so he got on the horse. The rest of us are just trailing along because we're walking.
Right.
And the kid with the horse is going along.
Right.
So off goes the guy with the truck, goes up the things, takes a left, goes up over the slope. But he's going fast because he knows he has to keep moving.
He needs
the speed. Meanwhile, the horse is going like, there's my master. There's my master. Here's Art going like this.
It's
a wonder he didn't fall off, but he didn't. Anyway, so that's how we got rescued.
Cool.
So then
how did you turn the tow truck around?
Well, that's the other thing. So there we were up on the top of the thing. We fortunately, we just decided, okay, we're going to drive down. We drove in to Jacob Lake,
okay,
which had a phone booth, and that was yeah, all it had.
Yep.
Nothing else was open.
No pie? No cookies?
I don't know. I don't remember anything. We were more concerned about trying this.
Right.
So we called the number. But what we didn't realize was Jacob Lake was on Utah phone
time
thing. Yeah, or not time, but just the code.
Oh, the code. Erie code.
Phone was hooked
yeah,
up to Utah.
Yeah.
So we sort of didn't realize what was going on, why we weren't reaching with the number we had.
Okay.
So we drove to Fredonia and Kanab.
In Arizona. Fredonia's in Arizona.
Yeah, but we went to Kanab.
Oh, okay.
And used enough, you know, and there we knew enough to that we were calling out of state.
Okay.
So we used,
That's curious that Jacob Lake is using a...
Yeah, it was
state.
Back then. Oh. Anyway.
Okay.
So we got a hold of the museum and they had... by now it was Monday morning,
okay,
and they had gotten the tow truck and with the directions and stuff. So they tried to stop the tow truck. And fortunately, they were able to stop it at about Cameron or someplace
okay,
like that. The truck was able to pick up another fare that had,
great,
and go
someone
back to Flagstaff.
Down.
With the, yeah. So we only had to pay the part for, we did
there,
pay the part or, going to Cameron or whatever,
okay,
which ended up being like $150, which at that time we paid ourselves because we figured it was a little bit of our own. We thought it was, sort of our stupidity and stuff, which it wasn't really too much of that. But anyway, we did pay for that. But we got the tow truck stopped. And I don't know if they would have had us long enough flying anyway to reach us, but whatever.
Yeah.
So that was an adventure that we had up
Adventures
there.
Adventures in plant hunting.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
So
cool.
That's two sites on that I remember about with the BLM types of things.
Okay.
But we got into some neat country. Eventually, Art found some plant called Rosa stellata that wasn't even recorded in Arizona, and he found a population of it and decided it was a different subspecies than the one that was known from New Mexico, and so he was able to get a publication out of that.
Cool.
And he eventually
Did he find it roughly? Was this on the strip?
Yeah, it's on the strip.
Okay.
It's on one of the points that goes out overlooking the Grand Canyon,
like Kelly Point kind of thing, way out there on the way out west. Or
it's sort of out west. It starts with T, I think, but I can't remember. Right offhand.
Get a look map.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Anyway,
okay.
so that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And he did
mm-hmm.
a lot further work on the BLM later.
Okay.
Years later. And stuff.
All right. Okay.
And so that, but this is the initial work.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about Don Keller.
Oh, okay.
Because I don't think I asked you about Don yet.
We didn't know him that well at the time, but I have gotten to know him. He stayed with the museum and did contract work a lot. In the recent years, I've gone on venture trips with him, and I'm really good friends with his current girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And so he lives right around the corner from me and all of that kind of thing. So I've gotten to know him better in the last, 15, 20 years than I knew at the time.
You met him in the late 70s then?
Well, he was the one that was called out. We didn't actually make contact in there, but he would be working at the museum when we were working there. I don't remember him from then, but he was the one that actually was able to tell the point on the map and how to get there for the truck driver. I don't think he came out with the truck. I think he just...
But he was the archaeologist. One of many, Lex Lindsay, Christy Turner. I'm just thinking.
Well, he's a field person.
Yeah.
He did a lot of field work.
So were those guys back in the day.
Yeah.
But that was in the 50s and 60s. And so now we're in the 70s.
I'm not sure who was the head archaeologist at that point. I don't remember.
Okay.
I mean, Lex Lindsay was there when we first started working at the museum.
What do you remember about him?
Not much.
Okay.
The problem,
because it would have been outside of your wheelhouse. I mean, he was in doing other things.
And... Right. We went there in 76,
okay.
And Herman Bleibtreu was the director at that time. And then about, well, some people started leaving after Herman left, and then there was a changeover of personnel around the early 80s, too, at the museum.
Okay.
Then that was sort of a massive, they fired all the direct heads of the different departments and put somebody that wasn't the head in charge. And Steve Carruthers was head of the department. He saw it coming. And so he had Art become the head of the department, and Art hired Steve back. So he did a flip. Bill Breed was out of town at the time, and when he came back, he didn't have a job, and the person that they hired didn't hire him, and Bill didn't want to be there under that regime, so he left.
Yeah.
And, you know, people...
I mean, this sounds like the power of government's working out. New regime comes in and fires everybody.
Yeah.
Was that what was going on?
Something happened, and we don't know exactly what, but we had quite a changeover of directors of the museum for a while while we were there. And as I semi-jokingly have told people, the average term of a director of the museum is between, other than the original, you know, Colton,
who are you thinking of?
Cindy Perrin's uncle. Danson. Ted Danson.
Oh, Ted Danson.
Ned Danson. Ned Danson was there a long time.
Okay.
But after him, the average term was about 3 to 5 years.
Oh, interesting.
And some were shorter than that.
Yeah.
And some would get fired for various reasons, like they were alcoholics or like that, you know, it just didn't fit.
Mismanaging funds or whatnot.
That happened. It wasn't the director that was the problem, but underneath the director, if something like that happened, you know, then they sort of left. And in the 80s, things were, we managed to keep going. So
was that when Bill Breed formed the Badgers? Do you know that story?
Yeah, I know the story, but that's quite
later.
A bit later.
So we're not going to go here yet.
Yeah, that's very much later.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're talking about
Don was there, and Don Keller was a survivor.
He probably was not a staff person. You know, he was probably somebody hired on grants.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can ask him, you know.
But
anyway, he told me that he was the one that figured that out.
Cool. All right. Okay, so into the early 80s, 83, of course, was the kind of big water year, or was a rain on snow for a normal year, but the reservoirs were all full and couldn't get the water out of them fast enough. But that's not really a plant issue. That's more of a water issue.
Right.
What
happened there was that it washed out all the work that we had done on the beaches.
Oh,
and I remember I had this article here. Which was published, but we had gone in and monitored these beaches. And there's a really nice summary here at the beginning of this, talking about the history of the beaches.
Okay.
And it talks about why we were studying them. It talks about the hypotheses about the river monitoring study was designed to assess and develop measures to mitigate recreation-induced impacts, both ecological and aesthetic, of the Colorado River Corridor. The following hypotheses included, and they talked about density of negative aesthetic indices, litter, feces, charcoal, anthills, etc., change because they put the charcoal in the river that.
Yeah.
Changes in plant community. Faster than they could be, come back.
Right.
The plant communities are influenced by different patterns within a campsite and change as a result of successional or degrading factors. Anyway, so this is all about the campsites here. And then there's a hydrologic history. And then there was how many people came into the canyon. And I thought that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because very few people from 1867 in 1869 to 1940, and then they start enumerating in the 1940s, and then on to the current. And by the time we got there, we were jumping into about 9,000 people,
mm-hmm.
almost 10,000 people a year.
Right.
We're going through the canyon. So there's a big increase in impacts and stuff like that.
Huge.
And so they want the Park Service wanted it studied.
Yeah.
And that's how we got involved. So that was very nice. And then we were involved with the museum at going on these. So anyway, this document has the history of the whole process of what we did.
Cool.
And becomes a museum in Northern Arizona Bulletin. This is the final, after the final report got turned in.
Okay.
So anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is a big, major project that we did. Still going on in the Grand Canyon while we're starting to work on the BLM stuff.
Hmm.
So, but the thing is that this was published after the big outflow.
Published after 83. Was it 83 or was it 84? When did it actually
get published? It was 83 is when I remember the issue.
What's the published date on it?
This is 86, I think. 86.
Right, so all that 83, and then they ran the river at 45.
But we didn't go back.
We
didn't go back. We used the information that we had. So this is the before.
Yeah, yeah.
And the USGS started taking over the river monitoring after that.
Got it.
And so whether they went back to the exact same rivers or not, I don't know. They they have collected all the literature on the Grand Canyon stuff.
Yeah.
So it's very documented and everything. I just haven't been involved with it since then.
Okay.
But when we went down, I went down on a lot of winter river trips. We went on the spring ones, like, well, spring starting in March because you're at lower elevation. So we had river trips March and April, sometimes into May. And I remember May trips working on these beaches. It got really hot.
When did you start that? When were you picking those up?
When did we start working on this project?
Yeah.
Let's see. Well, here's the profile. It says Carruthers, Atchison, and Johnson in 1979. Of course, we were at the museum in 76. Don't know when we actually. Okay, contracted in 82.
Okay.
To do this recreational things.
Ah, okay.
Okay. So we were, we've been doing the work on the BLM lands in the 70s.
Right.
And so by 82, we were also starting. Yeah, so we did listing packages, 81 and 82, 77 threatened and endangered plants. So we botanists were heavily involved in the rare plant stuff.
And that package was for the Fish and Wildlife Service?
That's for the Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah,
but we were also starting to work on this, starting in 82 for the river beaches.
Okay.
And they had a lot of data because Steve Carruthers had been working since the 70s, right? We were in 73 or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was just that doing those earlier trips, they noticed the impacts and said, this is not right. You know, there's impacts here. But they had to persuade to get the funding to actually do the studies.
Right.
So then we did the studies.
Okay.
And like I mentioned, after we did the studies on here, we also did studies up in Glen Canyon too, you know, and below the dam.
When did the Glen Canyon studies start?
I don't know. It was after this. But they weren't as detailed. It was just, there's problems there too.
Right.
And after we had made suggestions what to do here, then they took the same suggestions and did them in the camp. See, this has here, at the end of this, the different things that I mentioned at the beginning, and then they have the solution, or a solution suggested, conclusions and recommendations.
Okay.
And so establish baseline conditions, and that's what had been hurt by the
by the flood.
By the floods and stuff like that. So that was a big problem because we did these plots in the fall of 1982, and then they had the big washouts. So unanticipated were the major flash floods for the sites.
Were you able to see between 82 and the next time you were on the river that wasn't at 45,000 constant flow?
Mm-hmm.
Were you able to see changes? You're like, oh wow, that's really changed. That whole camp is gone. Or were they bigger? Or what had happened?
I didn't go in the upper part of the canyon.
Okay.
After that, I went. We did trips paid for by the Wallapais.
So Diamond Down trips.
Diamond Down trips.
Okay. Okay.
Which, of course, we were very much more familiar with that part of the canyon anyway.
Hmm.
So, yeah, we did those trips.
Okay.
I don't remember any others.
So we've been talking for about an hour. I wonder if this is a good place to put a comma in this interview series.
Yeah, totally.
And then next time, we'll talk about the Grand Canyon plant studies, starting with this 82 study.
Okay.
Does that sound like a plant?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And we did have a couple things before that, was the trails and the campsites along trails into the canyon too. Like, we also did that.
When was that?
A little earlier.
Okay.
So, yeah, that was the first.
Was that like 1980,
81? I have to look at this. It was my first hiking in the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
Other than the hiking, you know, that we did with Dr. Mason and that sort of stuff. This goes with that. Here's one. Here's another one that goes with that. This is 1980.
Okay.
Resource managing human impact on the beaches. So those are two beaches ones. But there is one on the trails.
Okay.
Sorry about that. I don't have that right today.
Okay.
But
we'll talk about the trails first. Yeah. So we'll talk about that next time.
Yeah.
Good. All right. Well, with that, let's conclude part 12 of Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Barbara Phillips. Today is Tuesday. It's April 1st, 2025. And Barb, thank you so very much.
Okay. Thank you.